This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bread Givers, a novel third edition, by Anzia Yezerska. Narrated by Gabra Zachman. Book 1. Hester Street. Chapter 1. Hester Street. I had just begun to peel the potatoes for dinner when my oldest sister, Bessie, came in, her eyes far away and very tired. She dropped on the bench by the sink and turned her head to the wall. One look at her, and I knew she had not yet found work. I went on peeling the potatoes, but I no more knew what my hands were doing. I felt only the dark hurt of her weary eyes. I was about 10 years old then. But from always it was heavy on my heart, the worries for the house, as if I was mother. I knew that the landlord came that morning hollering for the rent, and the whole family were hanging on Bessie's neck for her wages. Unless she got work soon, we'd be thrown in the street to shame and to laughter for the whole world. I already saw all our things kicked out on the sidewalk like a pile of junk, a plate of pennies like a beggar's hand reaching out of our bunch of rags. Each sign of pity from the passers-by, each penny thrown into the plate was another stab into our burning shame. Laughter and light footsteps broke in upon my dark thoughts. I heard the door open.
"Give a look only on these roses for my hat," cried Masha, running over to the looking-glass over the sink. With excited fingers she pinned pink paper roses under the brim.
Then, putting on her hat again, she stood herself before the cracked, fly-stained mirror and turned her head first on this side and then on the other side, laughing to herself with the pleasure of how grand her hat was.
"Like a lady from Fifth Avenue I look, and for only 10 cents, from a pushcart on Hester Street."
Again the door opened, and with dragging feet my third sister, Fania, came in. Bessie roused herself from the bench and asked, "No? Any luck with you?"
"Half the shops are closed," replied Fania. "They say the work can't start till they got a new president. And in one place, in a shirt factory, where they had a sign, 'Girls Wanted,' there was such a crowd of us tearing the clothes from our bodies and scratching out each other's eyes in the mad pushings to get in first, that they had to call 2 fat policemen with thick clubs to make them stand still in a line for their turn. And after we waited for hours and hours, only 2 girls were taken."
Masha looked up from the mirror.
"Didn't I tell you not to be such a yok and kill yourself pushing on a line a mile long when the shop itself couldn't hold those that were already on the doorstep? All the time that you were wasting yourself waiting to get in, I walked myself through the stores to look for a trimming for my hat."
"You heartless thing," cried Bessie. "No wonder father named you Empty Head. Here you go to look for work, and you come back with pink roses for your dull face."
Undisturbed by the bitter words, Masha finished the last stitch and then hung up her hat carefully over the door.
"I'm going to hear the free music in the park tonight," she laughed to herself, with the pleasure before her. "And these pink roses on my hat to match out my pink calico will make me look just like the picture on the magazine cover."
Bessie rushed over to Masha's fancy pink hat as if to tear it to pieces, but instead she tore her own hat from her head, flung it on the floor, and kicked it under the stove. Masha picked up her shoulders and turned back to the mirror, taking the hairpins carefully from her long golden hair and fixing it in different ways.
"It ain't my fault if the shops are closed. If I take my lunch money for something pretty that I got to have, it don't hurt you none."
Worry or care of any kind could never get itself into Masha's empty head. Although she lived in the same dirt and trouble with us, nothing ever bothered her. Everywhere Masha went, men followed her with melting looks, and these melting looks in men's eyes were like something to eat and something to drink to her, so that she could go without her lunch money to buy pretty things for herself and not starve like the rest of us. She was no more one of us than the painted lady looking down from the calendar on the wall. Father's preaching and mother's cursing no more bothered her than the faraway noise from the outside street. When Masha walked in the street in her everyday work dress that was cut from the same goods and bought from the same pushcart like the rest of us, it looked different on her. Her clothes were always so new and fresh, without the least little wrinkle, like the dressed-up doll lady from the show window of the grandest department store. Like from a born queen, it shined from her. The pride in her beautiful face, in her golden hair, lifted her head like a diamond crown. Masha worked when she had work. But the minute she got home, she was always busy with her beauty, either retrimming her hat or pressing her white collar or washing and brushing her golden hair. She lived in the pleasure she got from her beautiful face, as Father lived in his holy Torah. Masha kept part of her clothes in a soapbox under the bed. Everything in it was wrapped around with newspapers to keep the dirt out. She was so smart in keeping her things in perfect order that she could push out her box from under the bed in the middle of the dark night and know exactly where to put her hand to find her thin lace collar or her handkerchief or even her little beauty pin for the neck of her shirtwaist. High up with a hanger, on a nail nearly to the ceiling so that nobody's dirty hands should touch it, hung Masha's white starched petticoat, and over it her pink calico, and all around them an old sheet was tacked about with safety pins so she could tell if anybody touched it. It was like a law in the house that nobody dared touch Masha's things, no more than they dared touch Father's Hebrew books or Mother's precious jar of jelly which she always kept ready for company, even in the blackest times, when we ourselves had nothing to eat. Masha came home with stories that in rich people's homes they had silver knives and forks, separate for each person, and new iron tablecloths and napkins every time they ate on them. And rich people had marble bathtubs in their own houses with running hot and cold water all day and night long so they could take a bath any time they felt like it, instead of having to stand on a line before the public bathhouse, as we had to do when we wanted a bath for the holidays. But these millionaire things were so far over our heads that they were like fairy tales. That time when Masha had work hemming towels in an uptown house, she came home with another new rich idea, another money-spending thing, which she said she had to have. She told us that by those Americans, everybody in the family had a toothbrush and a separate towel for himself. Not like us, where we use one torn piece of a shirt for the whole family, wiping the dirt from one face onto another. "Empty head," cried Mother. "You don't own the dirt under their doorstep, and you want to play the lady." But when the day for the wages came, Masha quietly went to the 5- and 10-cent store and bought not only a toothbrush and a separate towel for herself, but even a separate piece of soap. Mother tore her hair when she found that Masha made a leak of 30 cents in wages where every cent had been counted on. But Masha went on brushing her teeth with her new brush and wiping her face with her new towel. And from that day, the sight of her toothbrush on the shelf and her white fancy towel by itself on the wall was like a sign to us all that Masha had no heart, no feelings, that millionaire things willed themselves in her empty head while the rest of us were wearing out our brains for only a bite in the mouth. As Mother opened the door and saw all my sisters home, the market basket fell from her limp arm. "Still yet no work?" she wrung her hands. "6 hungry mouths to feed and no wages coming in." She pointed to her empty basket. "They don't want to trust me anymore. Not the grocer, not the butcher. And the landlady is tearing from me my flesh, hollering for the rent." Hopelessly, she threw down her shawl and turned to me. "Did you put the potatoes on to boil?" Then her eyes caught sight of the peelings I had left in the sink. "Goslin! Bandit!" Her cry broke through the house. She picked up the peelings and shook them before my eyes. "You'd think potatoes grow free in the street. I eat out my heart running from pushcart to pushcart only to bargain down a penny on 5 pounds, and you cut away my flesh like a murderer." I felt so guilty for wasting away so much good eating. I had to do something to show Mother how sorry I was. It used to be my work to go out early every morning while it was yet dark, and hunt through ash cans for unburned pieces of coal, and search through empty lots for pieces of wood. But that morning I had refused to do it anymore. It made me feel like a beggar and thief when anybody saw me.
"I'd sooner go to work in a shop," I cried.
"Who'll give you work when you're so thin and small like a dried-out herring?"
"But I'm not going to let them look down on me like dirt picking people's ashes."
And I cried and cried so that Mother couldn't make me do it. But now, I quietly took the pail in my hand and slipped out. I didn't care if the whole world looked on me. I was going to bring that coal to Mother, even if it killed me.
"You've got to do it. You've got to."
I kept talking to myself as I dug my hand into the ashes.
"I'm not a thief. I'm not a thief. It's only dirt to them. And it's fire to us. Let them laugh at me."
And I did not return home till my pail was full of coal. It was now time for dinner. I was throwing the rags and things from the table to the window, on the bed, over the chairs, or any place where there was room for them. So much junk we had in our house that everybody put everything on the table. It was either to eat on the floor, or for me, the job of cleaning off the junk pile 3 times a day. The school teacher's rule, a place for everything and everything in its place, was no good for us, because there weren't enough places. As the kitchen was packed with furniture, so the front room was packed with Father's books. They were on the shelf, on the table, on the windowsill, and in soap boxes lined up against the wall. When we came to America, instead of taking along feather beds and the samovar and the brass pots and pans like other people, Father made us carry his books. When Mother begged only to take along her pot for gefüllte fish and the 2 feather beds that were handed down to her from her grandmother for her wedding presents, Father wouldn't let her.
"Woman," Father said, laughing into her eyes, "what for will you need old feather beds? Don't you know it's always summer in America? And in the new golden country where milk and honey flow free in the streets, you'll have new golden dishes to cook in and not weigh yourself down with your old pots and pans. But my books, my holy books, always were and always will be the light of the world. You'll see yet how all America will come to my feet to learn."
No one was allowed to put their things in Father's room any more than they were allowed to use Masha's hanger. Of course, we all knew that if God had given Mother a son, Father would have permitted a man-child to share with him his best room in the house. A boy could say prayers after his father's death that kept the father's soul alive forever. Always Father was throwing up to Mother that she had borne him no son to be an honor to his days and to say prayers for him when he died. The prayers of his daughters didn't count because God didn't listen to women. Heaven and the next world were only for men. Women could get into heaven because they were wives and daughters of men. Women had no brains for the study of God's Torah, but they could be the servants of men who studied the Torah. Only if they cooked for the men and washed for the men and didn't nag or curse the men out of their homes, only if they let the men study the Torah in peace, then maybe they could push themselves into heaven with the men, to wait on them there. And so, since men were the only people who counted with God, Father not only had the best room for himself, for his study and prayers, but also the best eating of the house. The fat from the soup and the top from the milk went always to him. Mother had just put the soup pot and plates for dinner on the table when Father came in. At the first look on Mother's face, he saw how she was boiling, ready to burst. So instead of waiting for her to begin her hollering, he started,
"Woman, when will you stop darkening the house with your worries?" "When I'll have a man who does the worrying. Does it ever enter your head that the rent was not paid the 2nd month? That today we're eating the last loaf of bread that the grocer trusted me?"
Mother tried to squeeze the hard, stale loaf that nobody would buy for cash.
"You're so busy working for heaven that I have to suffer here such bitter hell."
We sat down to the table. With watering mouths and glistening eyes, we watched Mother skimming off every bit of fat from the top soup into Father's big plate, leaving for us only the thin, watery part. We watched Father bite into the sour pickle, which was special for him only, and waited, trembling with hunger, for our portion. Father made his prayer, thanking God for the food. Then he said to Mother,
"What is there to worry about, as long as we have enough to keep the breath in our bodies? But the real food is God's holy Torah."
He shook her gently by the shoulder and smiled down at her. At Father's touch, Mother's sad face turned into smiles. His kind look was like the sun shining on her.
"Shena,"
he called her by her first name, to show her he was feeling good.
"I'll tell you a story that will cure you of all your worldly cares."
All faces turned to Father. Eyes widened, necks stretched, ears strained not to miss a word. The meal was forgotten as he began.
"Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa was a starving poor man who had to live on next to nothing. Once his wife complained, 'We're so good, so pious. You give up nights and days in the study of the Holy Torah. Then why don't God provide for you at least enough to eat?' 'Riches you want?' said Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa. 'All right, woman, you shall have your wish.' That very evening he went out into the fields to pray. Soon the heavens opened, and a hand reached down to him and gave him a big chunk of gold. He brought it to his wife and said, 'Go buy with this all the luxuries of the earth.' She was so happy as she began planning all she would buy the next day. Then she fell asleep, and in her dream she saw herself and her husband sitting with all the saints in heaven. Each couple had a golden table between themselves. When the good angel put down for them their wine, their table shook so that half of it was spilled. Then she noticed that their table had a leg missing, and that is why it was so shaky. And the good angel explained to her that the chunk of gold that her husband had given her the night before was the missing leg of their table. As soon as she woke up, she begged her husband to pray to God to take back the gold he had given them. 'I'll be happy and thankful to live in poverty as long as I know that our reward will be complete in heaven.'"
Mother licked up Father's every little word like honey. Her eyes followed his shining eyes as he talked.
"Nu, Shena,"
he wagged his head,
"do you want gold on earth or wine of heaven?"
"I'm only a sinful woman," Mother breathed, gazing up at him.
Her finger stole a touch of his hand as if he were the king of the world.
"God be praised for the little we have. I'm willing to give up all my earthly needs for the wine of heaven with you. But Moisha," she nudged him by the sleeve, "God gave us children. They have a life to live yet here on earth. Girls have to get married. People point their fingers on me, a daughter 25 years already and not married yet, and no dowry to help her get married."
"Woman, stay in your place."
His strong hand pushed her away from him.
"You're smart enough to bargain with the fish peddler. But I'm the head of this family. I give my daughters brains enough to marry when their time comes, without the worry of a dowry."
"No? You're the head of the family?"
Mother's voice rose in anger.
"But what will you do if your books are thrown in the street?"
At the mention of his books, Father looked up quickly.
"What do you want me to do?"
"Take your things out from the front room to the kitchen, so I could rent your room to boarders. If we don't pay up the rent very soon, we'll all be in the street."
"I have to have a room for my books. Where will I put them?"
"I'll push my things out from under the bed, and you can pile up your books in the window to the top, because nothing but darkness comes through that window anyway. I'll do anything, work the nails off my fingers, only to be free from the worry for rent."
"But where will I have quiet for my studies in this crowded kitchen? I have to be alone in a room to think with God."
"Only millionaires can be alone in America. By Zalman the fish peddler, they're squeezed together, 12 people in one kitchen. The bedroom and the front room his wife rents out to boarders. If I could cook their suppers for them, I could even earn yet a few cents from their eating."
"Woman, have your way. Take in your boarders, only to have peace in the house."
The next day, Mother and I moved Father's table and his chair with a back and a cushion to sit on. into the kitchen. We scrubbed the front room as for a holiday. Even the windows were washed. We pasted down the floppy wallpaper, and on the worst part of the wall, where the plaster was cracked and full of holes, we hung up calendars and pictures from the Sunday newspapers. Mother sent me to Mumenke, the herring woman on the corner, for the loan of a feather bed. She came along to help me carry it. "Long years on you," cried Mother, as she took the feather bed from Mumenka's arm.
"Long years and good luck on us all," Mumenka answered.
Mumenka worked as hard for the pennies as anybody on the block. But her heart was big with giving all the time from the little she had. She didn't have the scared, worried look that pinched and squeezed the blood out of the faces of the poor. It breathed from her the feeling of plenty, as if she had Rockefeller's millions to give away.
"You could charge your boarders twice as much for the sleeping if you give them a bed with springs instead of putting the feather bed on the floor," said Mumenka.
"Don't I know that a bed with a spring is a good thing? But you have to have money for it."
"I got an old spring in the basement. I'll give it to you."
"But the spring needs a bed with feet."
"Do as I done. Put the spring over 4 empty herring pails and you'll have a bed fit for the president. Now put a board over the potato barrel and a clean newspaper over that and you'll have a table. All you need yet is a soapbox for a chair and you'll have a furnished room complete."
Mumenka's bent old body tottered around on her lame foot as she helped us. Even Mother forgot for a while her worries. So like a healing medicine was Mumenka's sunshine.
"Ah,"
sighed Mother, looking about the furnished room complete. "God should only send a man for Bessie to marry herself in good luck."
"Here's your chance to get a man for her without the worry of a dowry. If God is good, he might yet send you a rich boarder."
From the kitchen came Father's voice chanting,
"When the poor seek water, and there is none, and their tongue faileth for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them."
Mother put her hand over Mumenka's mouth to stop her talking. Silent, breathless, we peeked in through the open crack in the door. The black satin skullcap dipped on the side of his head set off his red hair and his long red beard, and his ragged satin coat from Europe made him look as if he just stepped out of the Bible. His eyes were raised to God, his two white hands on either side of the book, his whole body swaying with his song.
"And I will bring the blind by a way that they know not. I will lead them in paths that they have not known. I will make darkness light before them, and crooked things straight. These things will I do unto them, and not forsake them."
Mother's face lost all earthly worries. Forgotten were beds, mattresses, borders, and dowries. Father's holiness filled her eyes with light.
"Is there any music on earth like this?"
Mother whispered to Mumenka.
"Who would ever dream that in America, where everything is only business and business, in such a lost corner as Hester Street, lives such a fine, such a pure silken soul as Reb Smolensky?
If he was only so fit for this world, like he is fit for heaven, then I wouldn't have to dry out the marrow from my head worrying for rent."
His voice flowed into us deeper and deeper. We couldn't help ourselves. We were singing with him.
"Sing, O heavens, and be joyful, O earth, and break forth into singing, O mountains, for the Lord hath comforted his people."
Suddenly it grew dark before our eyes. The collector lady from the landlord! We did not hear her till she banged open the door. Her hard eyes glared at Father.
"My rent!"
she cried, waving her thick diamond fingers before Father's face. But he didn't see her or hear her. He went on chanting.
"Awake! Awake! Put on strength, O arm of the Lord! Awake! As in ancient days in the generations of old. Art thou not he that hath cut Rahab and wounded the dragon?"
"Snorer!"
shrieked the landlady, her fat face red with rage.
"My rent!"
Father blinked his eyes and stared at the woman with a far-off look.
What is it? What do you want?
Don't you know me? Haven't I come often enough? My rent! My rent, my rent I want!
Oh, your rent.
Father met her angry glare with an innocent smile of surprise.
Your rent? As soon as the girls get work, we'll pay you out, little by little.
Pay me out, little by little? The cheek of those dirty immigrants! A fool I was, giving them a chance another month!
But we haven't the money.
His voice was kind and gentle, as hers was rough and loud.
Why haven't you the money for rent? She shouted.
The girls have been out of work.
Father's innocent look was not of this earth.
Hear him only, the dirty do-nothing. Go to work yourself. Stop singing prayers. Then you'll have money for rent.
She took one step towards him and shut his book with such anger that it fell at her feet. Little red threads burned out of Father's eyes. He rose slowly, but quicker than lightning flashed his hands. A scream broke through the air. Before we had breath enough to stop him, Father slapped the landlady on one cheek, then on the other, till the blood rushed from her nose.
You painted piece of flesh, cried Father. I'll teach you respect for the Holy Torah.
Screaming, the landlady rushed out, her face dripping blood as she ran. Before we knew what or where, she came back with two policemen. In front of our dumb eyes, we saw Father handcuffed like a thief and taken away to the station house. Bessie and Fanya came home still without work. When they heard that Father was arrested, it was as though their heads were knocked off. Into this thick sadness, Masha came, beautiful and smiling, like a doll from a show window. She hung up her hat with its pink roses on her nail on the wall, and before she had time to give a look at her things in the box, to see that nobody had touched them, she rushed over to the mirror, and with her smile of pleasure in herself, she said,
A man in the place where I was looking for work asked to take me home, and when I wouldn't let him, still he followed me. The freshness of these men! I can't walk the street without a million eyes after me.
Silence and gloom were her only answer. Masha stopped talking, turning from the mirror for the first time, gave a look at us.
What happened? It's like a funeral in the house.
The landlord's collector lady was here, and...
Well, what of it?
She was hollering for the rent.
Then why didn't they pay her the rent?
Asked the innocent doll face.
Don't everybody pay rent?
Mother began to scream and knock her head with her fists.
A stone! An empty-headed, brainless stone I had for a child! My own daughter, living in the same house with us, asking, Why did the landlady come? Why don't they pay her the rent?
Not listening to Mother's cursing and screaming, Masha looked about for something to eat. The stove was cold. No food was on the table.
Why ain't there something to eat? I'm starved.
Then Masha caught sight of two quarters on the table that Mumenka had left when she came to comfort us.
What should I buy for supper?
Masha asked, reaching for the money. Before she could get to the quarters, I leaped to the table and seized one of them.
Mama, I begged, let me go out to peddle with something. I got to bring in money if nobody is working.
Woe is me, Mother cried. How can I stand it? An empty head on one side and a craziness on the other side.
Nobody is working and we got to eat, I kept begging. If I could only peddle with something, I could bring in money.
Let me alone, crazy head.
No wonder your father named you Blut und Eisen.
When she begins to want a thing, there is no rest, no let-up till she gets it. It wills itself in you to play peddler and waste away the last few cents we got.
As long as we're not working, said Bessie, whatever Sarah will earn will be something. Even only a few cents will buy a loaf of bread.
Without waiting for Mother to say yes, I ran out with the quarter in my hand. I saw Masha go to a pushcart of Frankfurters. But I, with my quarter, ran straight to Mumenka.
I got to do something, I yelled like a fire engine. Nobody is working by us. Nobody, nobody. What should I buy to sell quick to earn money?
Mumenka thought for a minute, then said,
I got some old herring left in the bottom of this barrel. They're a little bit squashed, but they ain't spoiled yet, and you'll be able to sell them cheap because I'll give them to you for nothing.
No, no, I'm no beggar, I cried. I want to go into business like a person. I must buy what I got to sell.
And I held up the same quarter that Mumenka had given Mother.
Good luck on you, little heart,
Mumenka's old eyes smiled into mine.
Go, make yourself for a person. Pick yourself out 25 herring at a penny apiece. You can easy sell them at 2 cents, and maybe the ones that ain't squeezed for 3 cents.
On the corner of the most crowded part of Hester Street, I stood myself with my pail of herring.
Herring! Herring! A bargain in the world! Pick them out yourself! 2 cents apiece!
My voice was like dynamite. Louder than all the pushcart peddlers, louder than all the hollering noises of bargaining and selling. I cried out my herring with all the burning fire of my 10 old years. So loud was my yelling for my little size that people stopped to look at me, and more came to see what the others were looking at.
Give only a look on the sales lady, laughed a big fat woman with a full basket. Also a person, laughed another, also fighting already for the bite in the mouth. How old are you, little skinny bones? Ain't your father working?
I didn't hear. I couldn't listen to their smartness. I was burning up inside me with my herring to sell. Nothing was before me but the hunger in our house, and no bread for the next meal if I didn't sell the herring. No longer like a fire engine, but like a houseful of hungry mouths, my heart cried,
Herring! Herring! 2 cents apiece!
First one woman bought, and then another, and another.
Some women didn't even stop to pick out the herring, but let me wrap it up for them in the newspaper, without even a look if it was squashed or not. And before the day was over, my last herring was sold. I counted my greasy 50 pennies.
25 cents profit. Richer than Rockefeller, I felt. I was always saying to myself, if I ever had a quarter or a half dollar in my hand, I'd run away from home and never look on our dirty house again. But now I was so happy with my money. I didn't think of running away. I only wanted to show them what I could do and give it away to them. It began singing in my heart, the music of the whole Hester Street, the pushcart peddlers yelling their goods, the noisy playing of children in the gutter, the women pushing and shoving each other with their market baskets. All that was only hollering noise before melted over me like a new, beautiful song. It began dancing before my eyes, the 25 herring that earned me my 25 cents. It lifted me in the air, my happiness. I couldn't help it. It began dancing under my feet, and I couldn't stop myself. I danced into our kitchen, and throwing the 50 pennies like a shower of gold into my mother's lap, I cried,
Now will you yet call me crazy head? Give only a look what blood and iron has done.
Chapter 2. The Speaking Mouth of the Block.
Even butchers and bakers and common moneymakers have sometimes their use in the world, said Father.
He had just come home free from the court, and Mother was telling him how the butcher and baker and Zalman the fish peddler left their work to bail him out, and how they raised the money together for the best American-born lawyer to take his part.
No, why shouldn't they take my part? Said Father. Am I not their light? The whole world would be in thick darkness if not for men like me who give their lives to spread the light of the Holy Torah.
It was like a holiday all over the block when they had Father's trial. The men stopped their work. The women left their cooking and washing and marketing, and with babies on their arms and babies hanging onto their skirts, they crowded themselves into the court to hear the trial.
In high American language, the lawyer made a speech to the judge and showed with his hands all those people who looked up to Father as the light of their lives. And then he told the court to look on Father's face, how it shined from him, like from a child, the goodness from the holy life of prayer. He couldn't hurt a fly,
the lawyer said.
Reb Smolinski would turn aside not to step on the littlest worm under the feet.
And he called on the neighbors to give witness how Father loved only stillness and peace and his learning from his books. And if he hit the landlady, it was only because she burst into the house in the midst of his prayers and knocked his Bible out of his hands and stepped on it with her feet.
"It's a lie!" cried the collector lady.
Then our smart lawyer asked the judge to have made a print of her foot on a white piece of paper, and when he showed up together the page in the Bible where her wet, muddy foot stepped, and the print on the white paper, everybody could see it was the same shoe. For a minute it was so still in that court, as if somebody had just died and everybody was scared to draw his breath.
"Prisoner discharged," said the judge.
The crowd got so excited, yelling and shouting with gladness, they almost carried Father home over their heads. For weeks after, everybody was talking about Father. By the butcher, by the baker, by the fish market, everybody was telling everybody over and over again, as you tell fairy tales, how Father hit the landlady when she stepped on the Holy Torah. In the evening, when everybody sat out on the stoop, the women nursing their babies, the men smoking their pipes, and the girls standing around with their young men, their only talk was how Father was the speaking mouth of the block. Not only did he work for the next world, but he was even fighting for the people their fight in this world. Everybody was scared to death when the landlord came around, and Father hitting the landlord's collector lady was like David killing Goliath, the giant. Sprenze Gittel put the baby down in the gutter, stuck a nipple into its mouth to keep it quiet, and right before everybody on the stoop acted out, like on the stage, the way Father hit the landlady first on one cheek and then on the other. All the people stamped their feet and clapped their hands with pleasure of getting even, once in their lives, with someone over them that was always stepping on them.
"She deserves it yet worse, the fresh thing," said the rag picker. "She insults enough the people."
"But a man shouldn't hit a lady,"
said Sprinza Gittel's Americanized daughter, who was standing around with her American-born young man.
"A collector for the landlord ain't a lady," cried Sprinza Gittel. "For insulting her own religion, they should tear her flesh in pieces. They should boil her in oil and freeze her in ice." "I hate the landlord worse as a pawnbroker," Hannah Haye, the washwoman. "Every month of your life, whether you're working or not working, whether you're sick or dying, you got to squeeze out so much blood to give the leech for black walls that walk away, alive with bedbugs and roaches and mice."
"He lives himself on Riverside Drive, and his windows open out into sunshine from the park. So why should he worry if it's to get choked with smoke in my dark kitchen every time I got to light the fire to cook something?" said the shoemaker's wife from the basement.
"If the landlord wills himself another diamond on his necktie, or if his wife wants a thicker fur coat, all he got to do is raise our rent."
"But you people are unreasonable,"
said the bookkeeper, who was always wearing a white starched collar on his neck.
"Poor people are yet too much reasonable because they can't help themselves," interrupted Hannah Haye. "It's the landlords who don't want to fix or paint the houses and yet keep on raising the rent what are unreasonable."
"But the landlord has to pay taxes, and when they raise his taxes, he must raise the rent."
"Taxes? Rich people got enough money for taxes and other pleasures. I should only have the worry for paying taxes on $1 million.
And so it kept on, and the arguments always ended with, "Long years on Reb Smolinski to fight the landlords for the people." Soon everybody from all around knew us so well, it got easy for us to rent the front room. First one came, then another, and then a third. And when Mother wanted to squeeze in another boarder, they said they'd better each pay yet another quarter a week more and not have another boarder in the same room. Things began to get better with us. Bessie, Fanya, and Masha got work. But still, I kept on peddling herring. Earning 25 and sometimes 30 to 50 cents a day made me feel independent, like a real person. It was already back of me to pick coal from ash cans. I felt better to earn the money and pay out my own earned money for bought coal. Mother began to fix up the house like other people. The installment man trusted us now. We got a new table with 4 feet that were so solid it didn't spill the soup all over the place. Masha got a new-looking glass from the second-hand man. It had a crack in the middle, but it was so big she could see herself from the head to the feet. Mother even bought regular towels. Every time we wiped our faces on them, it seemed so much behind us the time we had only old rags for towels. We bought a new soup pot, and enough plates and spoons and forks and knives so we could all sit down by the table at the same time and eat like people. It soon became natural, as if we were used from always to eat with separate knives and forks instead of from the pot to the hand as we once did. Once in a while we even had butter on our bread. And when eggs were cheap and Mother got a bargain at a pushcart, a lot of cracked eggs, then we had eggs for breakfast, just like the boarders. Now all of us had meat for the Sabbath, not only Father, and sometimes Mother had a half chicken for Father. But the more people get, the more they want. We no sooner got used to regular towels than we began to want toothbrushes, each for himself like Masha. We got the toothbrushes and we began wanting tooth powder to brush our teeth with instead of ashes. And more we wanted more things, and really needed more things the more we got them. With the regular wages coming in each week, Mother became a new person. There was a new look in her eyes, and a new sound in her voice when she went to the grocery store with the dollar in her hand and bought what she wanted for cash instead of having to beg them to trust her. Sometimes, almost a whole day would pass without a curse or a scream from Mother. She even began to laugh once in a while and make jokes about soon buying a house and a fur coat for winter. When we sat down to our dinner, she'd begin to tell us of the years back when she was a young girl. Who'd believe me, here in America, where I have to bargain by pushcarts over a penny, that I once had it so plenty in my father's house? Pots full of fat, barrels full of meat, and boilers full of jelly we had packed away in our cellar. I used to make cake for the Sabbath with cream so thick you could cut it with a knife. Her eyes looked far away, like in a dream. When I'd go to a fair, everywhere I'd pass, people would draw their breath. They'd stop their bargaining and selling and stand back with sudden stillness, only to give a look on my face. See me only. Cheeks like red apples, skin softer and finer as pink velvet, long thick braids to my knees, eyes dancing out of my head with the life in me, and such a life as I once had. Wherever I gave a step, the whole earth burned under my feet. Give only a look on Masha. That's the picture of me how I was, only I was 100 times healthier. In my face was all the sunshine and fresh air of the open fields.
I looked on Mother's faded eyes, her shape like a squashed barrel of yeast, and her face black and yellow with all the worries from the world. "You looked like Masha?" I asked.
"Where do you suppose Masha got her looks? From the air?" Masha never had such color in her cheeks, such fire in her eyes, and my shape was something to look on. Not the straight up and down like the beauties make themselves in America.
The kitchen walls melted away to the far-off times in Russia, as Mother went on and on with her fairy tales till late hours of the night.
I was known in all the villages around, not only for my beauty. I was the first dancer on every wedding. You don't see in America such dancing like mine. The minute I'd give a step in, they'd begin clapping their hands and stamping their feet. The fiddlers began to play and sing the song they played. And the whole crowd, old and young, would form a ring around me and watch with open mouth how I lifted myself in the air, dancing the kozatske.
Once Mother got started, she couldn't stop herself, telling more and more. She was like drunk with the memories of old times.
When I got 14 years old, the matchmakers from all the villages, far and near, began knocking on our doors, telling my father the rich men's sons that were crazy to marry themselves to me. But Father said he got plenty of money himself. He wanted to buy himself honor in the family. He wanted only learning in a son-in-law. Not only could he give his daughter a big dowry, but he could promise his son-in-law 12 years free board, and he wouldn't have to do anything but sit in the synagogue and learn. When the matchmaker brought your father to the house the first time, so my father could look him over and hear him out his learning, they called me in to give a look on him, but I was so ashamed I ran out of the house. But my father and the matchmaker stayed all day and all night. And one after another, your father chanted by heart Isaiah, Jeremiah, the Songs of David, and the Book of Job. In the morning, father sent messengers to all the neighbors to come and eat with him cake and wine for his daughter's engagement that was to be the next day. I didn't give a look on your father till the day of the engagement, and then I was too bashful to really look on him. I only stole a glance now and then. But I could see how it shined from his face, the high learning, like from an inside sun. Nobody in all the villages around had dowry like mine. 6 feather beds and 12 pillows. I used to sit up nights with all the servants to pluck the down from the goose feathers. So full of down were my pillows that you could blow them away with a breath. I went special to Warsaw to pick out the ticking for my bedding. All my sheets had my name embroidered with a beautiful wreath of flowers over it. All my towels were half-covered with red and blue embroidery, and on each was some beautiful words embroidered, such as happy sunshine, good morning, or good night. My curtains alone took me a whole year to knit, on sticks 2 yards long. But the most beautiful thing of my whole dowry was my hand-crocheted tablecloth. It was made up of little knitted rings of all colors, red, blue, yellow, green, and purple. All the colors of the rainbow were in that tablecloth. It was like dancing sunshine lighting up the room when it was spread on the table for the Sabbath. Ach, there ain't in America such beautiful things like we had home.
"Nonsense, Mama," broke in Masha. "If you only had the money to go to Fifth Avenue, you'd see the grand things you could buy."
"Yes, buy," repeated Mother. "In America, rich people can only buy, and buy things made by machines. Even Rockefeller's daughter got only store-bought, ready-made things for her dowry. There was a feeling in my tablecloth."
"But why did you leave that rainbow tablecloth and come to America?" I asked.
"Because the Tsar of Russia. Worms should eat him. He wanted for himself free soldiers to make pogroms. He wanted to tear your father away from his learning and make him a common soldier, to drink vodka with the drunken mujiks, eat pig, and shoot the people."
There was only one thing to do. Go to the brass-buttoned butchers and buy him out of the army. The pogromshiks. The minute they smelled money, they were like wild wolves on the smell of blood. The more we gave them, the more they wanted. We had to sell out everything and give them all we had to the last cent to shut them up. Then suddenly, my father died. He left us all his money, and your father tried to keep up his business, selling wheat and wine while he was singing himself the Songs of Solomon. Maybe Solomon got himself rich first and then sang his songs, but your father wanted to sing first and then attend to business. He was a smart salesman, only to sell things for less than they cost, and when everything was gone from us, then our only hope was to come to America, where father thought things cost nothing at all.
Chapter 3. The Burden Bearer. But Mother did not dream always about how good she had it as a young girl. If she had less to worry for the rent, so she had more time to worry for a man for Bessie, who was already 9 years older than Mother was when she got married. And there was no sign of a man yet, and no dowry to help get one. What Muminka said about the boarders didn't turn out that way, because all the boarders, the minute they gave a look at Masha, fainted away for her. And they didn't see at all Bessie, who carried the whole house on her back. Their eyes turned only on Masha, and their ears didn't hear anything but what Masha said. The men didn't know that if Masha was always shining like a doll, it was because Masha took first her wages to make herself more beautiful and left the rest of us to worry for the bread and rent. They didn't know that Masha, on her way home from work, always looked on the shop windows for what was the prettiest and latest style. They didn't know that all her time home, instead of helping with the housework, Masha was always before the mirror trying on her things, this way and that way, so as to make them more and more becoming to her, while Bessie would rush home the quicker to help Mother with the washing or ironing, or bring home another bundle of night work, and stay up till all hours to earn another dollar for the house. The men didn't know that Bessie gave every cent she earned to Father and had nothing left to buy herself something new. All they saw was that Masha was a pleasure to look on, while Bessie was so buried, with her nose in the earth helping the family, that they had no more eyes on her than on Mother. Even Fanya, the third sister, got herself a young man before Bessie did. In the air shaft facing our kitchen he lived. He was a boarder with Zaman, the fish peddler. Once when Fanya put her head out of the window to dry her hair, the young man began to talk to her. Then he told her about the night school where he was going, and he showed her the books he took from the free library. And soon, every evening, Fanya began to go to the same night school where the young man went, and he began writing her every day love poems, such grand, beautiful thoughts that read like from a book. And sometimes Fanya would read the poems the young man sent her to the girls on the stoop, and nobody would believe that such burning high thoughts came from that pale-faced, quiet-looking man that lived in that dark air-shaft hole with Zalman the fish peddler, and who was only a sweeper and cleaner in the corner drugstore. And so the neighbors saw Masha always with a bunch of men buzzing around her like flies around a pot of honey. They saw Fanya go to the night school and to the library with the writing young man. But Bessie had nobody. And you could see it in her face, how it ate her heart to have the younger sisters go out with men, and she had nobody. Nobody. And then it happened. Once, when it was the night for the wages, Bessie came home with three packages, a new oilcloth for the table, a remnant from a lace curtain to tack around the sink to hide away the rusty pipes, and a 10-cent roll of gold paper for the chandelier to cover up the fly dirt that was so thick you couldn't scrub it away. Masha wanted to go hear the free music in the park, but Bessie begged her to stay home. "Help me only this once to shine up the house a little. You two will feel good if somebody should come in and find the house looks decent, like by other people." And so excited was Bessie to clean up the house that she made us pull out everything to the middle of the room and scrub out the corners and under the bed. And when we packed all the junk away where it wouldn't show itself, the crowded kitchen got bigger, and there was more room to move around without knocking things over. And when we tacked the lace curtain around the sink and fixed fancy the chandelier with the gold paper and we spread out the new white oilcloth on the table, it looked like a new house. We were sitting like company, taking pleasure in our new